What kind of internet fanatic are you? Are you an exceptionalist? Are you an optimist? A techno-determinist? It helps to know. You can't open a newspaper or a web browser without stumbling on some op-ed or article about how the internet is somehow destroying or improving something. Our economy, our attention spans, our relationships, politics, eyesight, sleeping habits, fiber intake. There's an intellectual battle going on around the internet. It's one that questions our fundamental assumptions about how culture and technology work. But it also involves our own personal attitudes and psychoses. So how are you supposed to know what to think about the internet? Unlike 17 Magazine, there's no simple multiple-choice quiz. But today's guests have done a little simplification, and they've categorized some of the prevailing schools of thought about the net to help us figure it all out. Our very own David Weinberger is an author and leading thinker on thinking about the internet, who is working on a new book about how we understand information in an information age. Tim Huang is a founder of RaffleCon, as well as a thinker, blogger, and meme tracker. I had them in the studio recently to help us figure it all out. Tim and David, you've been two of the voices who've been thinking on the thinking on the internet, actually doing the sort of self-reflective thinking on the thinking of the internet. You've actually broken up the internet into kind of schools of thought. Maybe you can start, David, and sort of describe what you posted up recently.
Well, it was sort of a joke, but I meant it lightly. Many of us have been through the Myers-Briggs evaluation, which takes four polarities, four dichotomies, and situates you along each of those polarities. And the result is a four-part score based upon a test that you take that frequently is actually fairly accurate. And it's like introvert, extrovert, sensing versus intuition, maybe perception versus intuition. I don't remember, but it's businesses like to give these to incoming employees either because they take them seriously or because it's sort of good icebreaker conversation openers. So I did one for what sort of internet fanatic are you? So the first is exceptionalism versus what I'm calling ordinarist. These are people, exceptionalists are people who think that the internet is a huge break with everything that came before it. It's as important as the printing press. It's as important as fire or whatever. That's, you know, the one extreme of
it. Just revolutionizes culture completely.
Throw everything out. It's the internet, baby. You know, that's exceptionalism. And the ordinarist says, yeah, you know, that's what they said about the telegraph. That's what they said about CB radio and the internet. Yeah, you know, but it's really not all that important. So that's one polarity. The second is techno-determinist versus contextualist. And techno-determinists are people who think that, and you saw more of this at the beginning of the internet, really, but that the internet by itself will change things. That it doesn't. You don't have to do anything. It's inevitable. It's going to happen simply because the internet now has arrived. And mm-hmm. that's, you know. The other side of that says, well, no, the internet is just a tool. It can be used for anything. Different cultures take it up differently. It has no meaning in itself. It has no effect in itself on people. And the third polarity is the really simple one. It's optimist versus pessimist. Do you think this is a good thing or it's a bad thing? Is it the shallows, the internet, and it's going to drive us, break up all of democracy and it's the end of civilization at one extreme, or the Messiah has arrived, or the 1960s have finally fulfilled themselves, or whatever your particular religious bent is, and that's at the other extreme. So you position yourself along those three axes, and you have a picture of what sort of internet fanatic you are.
And the last category or categorization has particularly popped up. I've seen a lot in the media right now. You saw the Wall Street Journal, editorials and a lot of like recent articles in the New York Times that have been deploring the reduction in attention spans and the trouble with multitasking and that kind of stuff.
The media loves a good internet bashing story. And this has been from the beginning of the internet. They have fastened on any form of research that shows that the internet is bad. They do a fair bit of internet boosting also, but it seems you want to make it into the media, then, which is too bad because there's serious concerns about the internet as well. There's I think there's very serious issues about what it's doing to us.
Well, and the fact that we take these concerns seriously in and of itself seems to kind of align us with that exceptionalist thinking. You know, if you do view the internet as a culturally changing phenomenon, you have to accept also that, you know, it is exceptionalist. It isn't just an ordinary another technology, like a toaster that came on.
So Nicholas Carr, in his recent book, The Shallows, a title I just love. I so wish I'd come up with that title. Beautiful title. Is a very strong and clear case of somebody who is an exceptionalist. The first half of the book, first third of the book is here are the huge things that have changed culture. It's printing press and fire and writing things down, and now the internet. So he's an exceptionalist. It's really important, but it's the rest of the book, the meat of the book is, and here's why the internet inevitably is changing our brains for the worse. So he's very clearly exceptionalist and a pessimist. And a techno-determinist, I believe. It's the internet itself is realigning your neurons. It's simply by interacting with the internet that your brain now, your plastic brain, is being fragmented and degraded.
Well, I want to get into why this kind of thinking is useful, why we categorize in that kind of thing. But I also want to give Tim an opportunity, because you've also thought about the way schools of thought on the internet could be categorized. I wonder if you could describe the kind of...
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I got into it from a little bit of a different direction, right? One of them is just, you know, that the internet, there's so many debates, right? And to a certain extent, no one is classifying them. And at least in my OCD brain, that's kind of a problem, right? You know, that there's so many issues and so many points of view across every single issue. The question is whether or not there's some way of simplifying these down. So you can say, well, there's these block of people who think this and these block of people who think this. And here are their assumptions and here are how these assumptions are changing over time. So one of the assumptions I thought a lot about has been the idea that the internet is a certain set of features as opposed to a technology. So what I mean by that is, like, the internet is open and it should be free for anyone to connect from point to point, right? But there's nothing inherent about internet technology or information technology that makes it that way. It's just that's how it was when it originally got started, and the group of people who kind of grew up around that and built on that think that's a valuable thing to protect, right? So the internet actually becomes like a bundle of features on top of the technology itself, as opposed to just like technology, right? So net neutrality is totally based on this debate, right? The idea that we should protect the web's openness because it has all these benefits, but really one of the assumptions is when we talk about the web and protecting the web, what we talk about is protecting those aspects of it. And I think that's great starting to think about that, because you can start to classify all the opposing portions of the debate and really kind of map out the intellectual space around the web, right? So, you know, one of the interesting shifts, I think, at least in Berkman's world, is, you know, the introduction of people like Esther, who kind of have this...
Esther Hargitay.
Esther Hargitay, yeah, she probably made it clear about that. Yeah.
Esther is a great non-techno-determinist, right? She's a huge contextualist.
Totally.
She's a sociologist, and so for her, a point that she's made, I think, very convincingly, both to Berkman and to, for example, the FCC, is that it's not enough just to drop technology off in somebody's house and expect, well, now you're on the internet. In fact, there's a whole set of social circumstances that determine how people or affect people how are going to use it.
There's even a way of taking a kind of like history of science point of view here, right? Like the instruments that we design and the experiments that we design to test certain hypotheses about the web are dependent on what we view the important part of the web being. And so I think it's really interesting because I guess it rethinks the web as like something empirical, right? Like we're learning more about the web and now we have these principles about how wikis work and that's how they work, right? And now you can take this and put it to whatever project you want versus, you know, the internet's kind of this amorphous thing that a lot of people are talking about and we're kind of trying to come to some common understanding about what it is. And then there's this kind of recursive effect of, you know, Yochai Benkler, publishes Wealth of Networks, and everyone's like, oh, okay, so now he's invented these motivations that we use to model humans on the web. And that's big from the point of view of even how we decide to try to experiment or research this stuff.
Well, what's been interesting to me about this is that there doesn't seem to be an effective analogy for what the net is. Like, there's not an existing set of technologies or frameworks that we can throw it in and say, well, the internet is like this per se.
That's because you're an exceptionalist. Right? I mean, the things exceptionalists say. Right? Well, they call it the information highway. It's not exactly a highway. It's not really about information. And they called it the universal library, but it's about much more than a library. And they call it, I'm totally with you. I am exactly that sort of exceptionalist, but that is the key mark of exceptionalism.
Yeah. Well, and this is why we're developing these kinds kinds of these new ways of categorizing and trying to understand what it is that we're talking about. And I wonder how what is this practice of categorization, and what's the kind of purpose of it?
So there's almost just like a valuable thing from the point of view of trying to understand what's going on in the discussion about the web. And it's important to do that, right? Because your assumptions about whether or not, for example, the internet is an exceptionalist type of device or something just like that's come before impacts what kind of policy you build around it, right? Like if the internet's just like a TV, then we're going to regulate it. We're going to build structures and institutions that reflect those assumptions.
You're listening to Radio Berkman from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society. This week, we're talking with David Weinberger and Tim Huang about thinking about the internet. Both David and Tim have been working on ways to categorize underlying assumptions about what the net is. David, who blogs at hyperorg.com, suggested Myers-Briggs tests for beliefs about the net. I asked him how reflecting on our assumptions about the internet can be useful.
Well, so I was making a joke, but with mine, it's not well thought through. It's sort of lighthearted. But I think Tim's point is exactly right, because there are policy and political implications, for example, that arise from not from the categorization itself, but from where the categorization helps you understand some assumptions that then explain why you have certain tendencies towards particular policies. So if you are, we'll say, a Berkman exceptionalist, and using, you know, combine our categories here, then you think that the internet is hugely important and really, really different, and because your focus on Berkman tends to look at it as a set of features or what I might call properties.
Right. That's much better.
We also want to preserve those properties. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm speaking usually broadly because these are all great generalizations, but the internet was open. The architecture was built to be open. You know, it doesn't have stuff built in order to control packets, determine who gets what sorts of packets based upon who sent them and what's in them, that sort of thing. All that's absent from the architecture. But because of the sort of, let's say, conservative exceptionalists that we are, we in general want to preserve that original nature of the internet. It's perfectly And once you see that that's a categorization, then, again, to reinforce what Tim said, well, that then immediately makes you think, there's obviously another way of looking at this. Wonder what that would be. For example, yeah, the internet started out that way, but it was young and ill-formed, and as it develops, it means changing the nature of its properties. The properties were great at the beginning, but they're going to develop. And since the internet is just code, which is a secret reference to more the Larry Lessig view of the internet, since the internet is just code, it could be whatever we want it to be. So the categorization helps you see why you're thinking what you think and what opposing positions might be.
And let you question your assumptions.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think there's a lot of, there's even the whole question about, like, security on the web, right? So if you talk to a lot of computer security people, right, there's some of them who are certainly in favor of continuing the openness of the web, but a lot of people will argue to you, quite rightly, right, like, that the open architecture has led to all sorts of problems with regards to having to defend against, threats to systems online. And that's kind of, again, sort of this emergent effect, right? Because you could argue that kind of conservative exceptionalism has been a very dominant paradigm for a very long time. And so the web that they produced was, you know, the web that we got. And now we're trying to sort of deal with that in some ways. So I think it's also pretty interesting, not just from the assumptions that people within sort of internet research, broadly speaking, are kind of coming up with, but also how other fields are approaching the web, right? So one of the great debates is, like, you sometimes hear about the web being talked about as, like, oh, it's an attention economy, right? Which is a whole another universe of assumptions about, you know, what the internet is for and what it does and how it works. And then there's also the whole rhetoric of, oh, the internet's actually an ecology, right? Mm. And both of those things actually have, like, a lot of implications about, like, if it's a market, then we regulate incentives. If it's an ecology, we regulate certain things because we feel that they're important environments to preserve.
Tim, you spent a lot of time over the last few years like cultivating a study of a kind of a culture of the internet that is around like 4chan and mm-hmm. memes. What kind of conclusions can we draw about this kind of group? Do you think that they fit in a specific kind of school of thought around the internet?
Yeah, we're working on this report right now for the Web Ecology Project, which is thinking about periodizing the last 15 years of internet culture. Right, so this is actually another kind of categorization that I think is pretty cool, which is we've had all this history of internet culture, right? But at least in the internet meme sort of world, it's like, okay, there's lolcats and then there's, hamster dance. And these are two funny internet celebrity phenomena, but they don't have any really connection between each other. And a lot of the discussion is kind of like that. It's like lightning strikes, right? Like these things are happening at random and they're all part of some phenomena, but really they're not connected. There's no rhyme or reason for why certain things happen when they do. And so what our periodization is trying to do is actually connect various communities through time. And when you start to do that, you start to view 4chan as actually just not 4chan alone, but actually 4chan as sort of layered with a bunch of other communities that came before and actually communities that came after as well. So we're calling them sort of lineages. They're sort of strata through history, right? So before 4chan, there's a community called Something Awful. There was something called, the General Mayhem Forums. And then after 4chan, there's something called Encyclopedia Dramatica. And so you can actually view these all as part of a chain, right?
Is it a causal chain? Is it the same people doing it? Is it the spread of a cultural idea from one group to another?
Yeah, I think that's kind of the interesting thing because arguably the communities here, they age, right? So like some of them... there are overlaps, but actually the more important part is like what they represent in terms of what culture and community online should be for. And so they share that in common, right? Because often a lot of these communities actually don't get along with each other at all. And they actually have pretty tightly drawn lines. But what links them actually is sort of patterns of practice. And so we draw kind of three in the report that we're putting out. One of them is this kind of 4chan line. Another one is kind of this sort of more marketized, commoditized platform.
That would be the ICANN has cheeseburger kind of.
Right. And specifically, and ICANN has cheeseburger is actually very interesting because I think we view it actually as a convergence point, right? Because there's ICANN has cheeseburger also seeks back a little back in time to, what you think of when you launch something like Facebook or MySpace or any of that stuff. Where the vision is to launch a platform that's kind of like broadly available for anyone versus 4chan, which is kind of more has its wagon circled more with regards to other people. And the third one we've kind of identified as a little bit of a weird one, which kind of connects XKCD and Reddit and Metafilter. And so the three distinctions we're drawing is for 4chan, the vision of online community is it's a place where you can do things that you'd want to do in the real world but can't. Right, so online is the space where I can afford to do that, and then the ICANN has cheeseburger, Facebook, MySpace kind of line is more about platforms that try to express the idea that the internet's supposed to be a good reflection of who you are in the real world, right, to a greater or lesser extent. So a lot of the memes that occur on Facebook are around expressing kind of the community that you already have with your friends, right? So like 20 random things about me is a great example of that. Mm-hmm. Versus the 4chan memes, which are about, like, let's continue developing this iterative language that less and less people will understand. What's helpful about this kind of categorization is that it kind of, you start to be able to make judgments actually over time, not just over, there's this thing called Facebook and it changed everything and that's it. That's the end of the story.
So you're not tracing the founders of one became the founders of another, or the disciples of one became the founders of another. It's not a sort of genetic causal.
No, yeah, I think it's more...
It's the development of three different ideas of community.
Right. Often it's just that the web is such an easy place to see stuff that a lot of the reproduction actually isn't genetic, right? So Moot from 4chan has said things like, I was really inspired by the activity happening on the General Mayhem forums and on Something Awful, so I decided to create a platform that was kind of like it. And I think that transmission alone is kind of interesting, right? Because we're talking on meta memes now, right? We're not just talking about like the fact that lolcats went from 4chan to Facebook, but we're talking about like the meta meme of like what a community online is for, or what people do online, like what kind of platform should we create?
How a community evolves.
Right, yeah.
This week we're talking with David Weinberger and Tim Huang about thinking about the internet. Tim studies the ecology and the economy of cultures on the net, particularly through the spread of memes, those little culture nuggets that vie for our attention online. I asked him how culture and communities evolve on the web in comparison to the real world. And you've seen communities evolve really, really quickly on the net, much faster than they could possibly evolve on in the real world.
Right. No, totally. And I think it's funny, too, because I think those assumptions play in again, right? So for the 4chan one, it's often about, I mean, if really what the center of them is you know, I can do things online that I can't do in the real world.
Such as?
Say lots of racial epithets and expletives, right? So
that you can't do because it's forbidden.
Yeah, it's forbidden, right? It's socially unacceptable, and so as a result, like, since there's only a small group of people who are actually interested in that, right? Like, the design of the community fits that in a lot of ways.
But they seem to be really, really interested in
it. Right. Yeah, really interested in it, right? So these communities emerge with certain kinds of common things, right? So, like, you don't have to reveal your real identity, for example. So handles are very evident, and anonymity is a strong thing. Contrast that with something like a Facebook or a MySpace, right, where the idea is to create a tool that anyone can use, and which roughly kind of maps onto what people are doing in the real world, right? So suddenly identity becomes very important. But also, a lot of these are become for-profit companies, mm-hmm. right? Because they need to acquire the sufficient capital in order to make it democratized, right? Like, I need to purchase enough servers to reach a scale where we can have a community of millions and millions of people, because that's my ultimate vision about what community online is for. Right. And so I think what's cool about this is, if you think about it from the line of these assumptions, you can also kind of start mapping up what are the features they eventually come to.
And do you think people in these communities, like the people behind Facebook or MySpace, for instance, are kind of categorizing things within themselves? They're going to be able to take, you know, the kind of categorization that the two of you have done and be able to apply that to, I don't know, like a how they envision the future of their community.
I mean, I think probably a lot of the beautiful stuff about this is actually that, Mark at Facebook, right, doesn't necessarily need to understand his assumptions because they're his assumptions, right? So Facebook acts that way just because that's kind of built into the culture, right?
Well, but we saw over the spring that he had a lot of assumptions about the net and mm-hmm. the way the community would work that it turned out that his community disagreed with.
Right. No, absolutely.
And he had a big reality check. And I don't know whether he's honestly turning a corner or if he's just kind of yielding to, you know, his community's desires.
Yeah, it's tough to say. It really is tough to say. And well, what's interesting, too, is I think there's a connection here to all the way back, right, to Lessig, right? So if you want to argue really that code is law, right, then there's suddenly a lot of power actually on the part of people who run these platforms to change features and really kind of craft the space that people are in, right? So, like, ultimately, Facebook backed off, but it doesn't necessarily mean they're going to back off forever, right? Mm-hmm. And if indeed their assumptions are built in a certain way, it also sets up their business model in a certain way, right? And that impacts their behavior probably even more, right, than people just complaining, so.
The possible contradiction between business model, business interests, and conceptual models mm-hmm. is both interesting and dangerous.
Yeah.
Because his set of, well, it's the obvious thing, his set of assumptions, which he may fully believe, may, you know, he's human. You got, you know, billions of dollars at stake. It may influence your categorization.
Yeah. Well, there seems to be a level of, like, Frankenstein's monster to this in the way that Zuckerberg took this company. He may have had this initial thought behind it and had a very deterministic belief in this, but it could be that he just developed his company and saw that there was profit in it and saw that it was growing exponentially hugely. And the monsters took over. And that leads to kind of a question that I had about how much we're letting the monster guide our thinking about it and how much we're actually taking the reins of the internet and saying that humans still have control over it. We're still
so right at the, just at the individual level, and the reins are held at multiple levels. Again, sort of a Lessig point, right? I mean, there's lots of factors that determine the fate of the internet, including world politics, you know, and then everything down to individual perceptions of it. And at the level, but just at the level of individual perceptions, one of the reasons why people take the Myers-Briggs test is that if you ask somebody, are you an introvert, extrovert, are you a censor or a judger or whatever the four, they can't tell you. They'll give you an answer, maybe, but it's an unreliable answer. If you give them the test, they may, if the test works, if there's any validity to it, you discover stuff about yourself that you couldn't know. And so the problem And you say, oh, I didn't know I thought I was an extrovert. I'm an introvert. You know, otherwise, it's totally uninteresting to do this. The reason that we need tests like that is that we are incapable of judging our own. The categories are things that we live in. They're not things that we simply look down upon and select among. I mean, it's right. These are not choices. These are things that we see through. They're our eyes. And so you need external ways of seeing how you're categorizing so you can see differently. And sometimes it's a Myers-Briggs test, and sometimes it's a test like that, and sometimes it's a paper by, say, Tim Huang on schools of thought on the internet. Sometimes it's just a terrible policy decision or a stupid thing that head of a large company does. You say, what was he thinking? It's basically what we do all the time, trying to figure ourselves out.
Right. And I think also it's there's a lot of path dependence when you're talking about platforms, right? Because at least with an individual person, you could be like, I took the Myers-Briggs and it turns out I'm an introvert. And like that explains why I'm really unhappy at parties, right? But when you're creating platforms and you're creating communities, right, like partially what you imbue those communities with actually takes on a momentum of its own, right? So, Anonymous acts largely independently of, Moot, even though Moot started the community, right? So he's created a space for things to happen. Now things are happening, but he can't really put the genie back in the bottle, right? And I think to some extent for Facebook as well, right? Mark is kind of the CEO of the company, but he has a board now, he has business units, he's got, all the kind of machinery that comes with a corporation. And I think it's very much along the same lines. There's a really cool idea, I forget the name for it, that I was reading about just the other day, where the argument is that that you can see the structure of an organization from the products it produces. So the idea is, if you're going to manufacture a car, right, like you have an organization that manufactures, you have a part of the business that manufactures the engine or the part that manages the steering wheel and that kind of stuff. And the connections between them are also part of that organization, right? So so the great example of this usually is like Apple, right? So they have design at the top of the org chart. And as a result, you see a lot of engineering decisions made to contort the technical side of it to actually fit the overall industrial design. And I think that's kind of an interesting idea, at least from the point of view of. Sorry, yeah. Go ahead.
I just want to be an internet exceptionalist.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
I can see the general idea of that, but if you're building a platform and the aim is to let the genie out of the bottle, mm-hmm. let everybody's genies out of everybody's bottles,
right.
Then the aim is to have something that's emergent, which makes it very hard to read backwards from the product to the design. Imperative, the design.
Right. Well, I guess, that's kind of an interesting question, right? So, I guess that's almost an empirical question, right? So, how fast do the starting assumptions of a community change? I guess what you're trying to say, right? Because, if they accelerate very quickly from once you've let the genie out of the bottle, then there's this complete decoupling from the person who started it and where people are right now. If it happens very slowly, then kind of within a certain set of time, then that remains true. Right. So I guess, I don't know. I guess probably the answer is probably more so from some organizations or certain platforms than others. Right.
So, I mean, Moot didn't set out to create a place that where people could be racists.
Mm-hmm.
In public. Right. We're going to start racist. Racism is going to be one of our platforms.
sure. Right. Okay. I can see that. Yeah. No, totally.
But that's sort of a constrained way of looking at what 4chan is, right? Is that if you only see it as a site for racists, then you are missing something essential about it.
Right. Yeah. No, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And presumably, presumably Facebook wasn't started with the assumption like we want to violate people's privacy. Right.
We're going to make a lot of money by
we're going to make a lot of money was the idea, not necessarily that we would make a business off of selling people's data and trying to push as much advertising down their throats.
Right. In a way, you could view Facebook as sort of, a kind of bipolar organization because they've got this level of user experience that's that they're very, excited about and building a community that people really want to be a part of. And then you've got the profit motive, which... those two can sometimes come into conflict.
Right. Well, actually, yeah. I guess I could totally see what you're trying to say. I mean, so maybe it isn't that you can read back the assumptions from what people are doing on a platform today. Like, read back the original assumptions.
Yeah, I'm no longer sure about what I just said, but please continue.
Sure. maybe the argument isn't, you can, for example, looking at 4chan, I can't be I know necessarily what Moot was thinking when he started it. right? Because platforms change, communities are evolving, so on and so forth. But what we can read probably is the results of those assumptions, right? So like, so essentially when you start a platform online, right? Like you're saying, I'm going to start a Wikipedia, it comes with certain assumptions. And it's essentially a natural experiment. We're relaunching it. And what we can read from the eventual community is just that, right? Like what the results of those assumptions are. So, for example, yeah, so you might be able to say, like, okay, and this is probably pulling it really far out, but, like, we can read from, going back to the discussion we had a few minutes ago, we can read from where the web is right now that the assumptions of openness resulted in all sorts of security questions or security problems, right? So we learn a little bit more about the web now, right? Like, if we create a technical platform with these kinds of assumptions, these are the kind of social results that emerge.
Well, you can also, if you have to read the right results. So if you only look at 4chan as racism, you only look at the web as a particular set of things. But if you, or Facebook, if you only look at Farmville and say, right. you know, oh, it's a gaming platform.
Yeah, right.
But if you look at the sweep of stuff at any of these, at 4chan, at Facebook, or the web itself, then I'm going to disagree with myself and agree with you that you can read backwards and say, you know, these all result from the choices about anonymity at 4chan, about Facebook's, I think, really stunning and brilliant idea of opening it up as an application, what the constraints there would be. So it's you can read backwards and say, well, it's the platform that's going to take advantage of the fact that it knows whom. And the web, likewise, and the net before that, you can say that the fact that we are now able to develop platforms with such ease, platforms in which emergence can happen, and so it can be difficult to read back, is itself a result of the feature property
of the internet, which
it wasn't for anything. It doesn't have a built-in set of – it has as few constraints as possible on the grounds that people will build things.
Right, absolutely,
which makes me a conservative exceptionalist.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I guess at this point we're thinking about the web, so.
It's been a really interesting conversation. I want to thank you both for coming and talking about this.
Thank you.
David Weinberger is an author and leading thinker on thinking about the internet, who is working on a new book about how we understand information in an information age. He blogs at hyperorg.com. Tim Huang is a founder of RaffleCon, as well as a thinker, blogger, and meme tracker. He blogs at brosifstalin.com. Want a second opinion? Find links to a bunch of articles and posts on this very topic at our blog, blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman. And what about you? Are you an exceptionalist, an optimist, a techno-determinist? Why not leave a comment on our show notes? This episode of Radio Berkman was produced by me, Daniel Dennis Jones, with the help of David Weinberger and Tim Huang at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts.